I think all that is necessary to be impressed by the talent that is available in this congregation is simply to sit in a worship service, to listen to prayers that are led, to listen to classes that are being taught, indeed to hear different lessons being brought from time to time, invitations offered on Wednesday evening. And I am very much impressed by that, indeed almost to the point of being overwhelmed. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak from time to time, but equally I look forward to having the opportunity to listen to others who are very effective and capable speakers. I know I enjoyed listening to Sewell last week, and often it's the case with a gospel preacher that he doesn't get to hear others very often, and that's certainly been the case being in England for 10 years. But I look forward to such opportunities and certainly appreciate the opportunity that you give me to speak from time to time. And I can equally say that I think it's a great challenge to be able to stand up among so many, so diverse, I suppose, in spiritual needs and backgrounds, and try and offer something that will be of help and encouragement to all of us. And that indeed is my prayer. I think all of us at one time or another pause to reflect upon what life is really about, and we have to ask ourselves the question, why are we here? How did we get here? What's the purpose for our existence? And I think it would be safe to say that really probably all men who live upon the face of the earth at some point or another have to struggle with that question. Now, they may dismiss it very quickly, and they may not think about it very long, but I think when we even go back, as far back as we can, in terms of written records that exist among various civilizations and cultures, men have always raised these kinds of questions. You can go back to the Greek philosophers and find them philosophizing about why are we here and how did we get here and what is the reason for our existence. That being the case, of course, there are many questions, as you are probably aware, that men arrive at in answer to those kinds of questions. And the questions, the answers that one has depends upon really the worldview, the outlook that one has upon life. I think there are those today who would answer the question, such as the agnostic, who would simply say, well, you know, we can't know answers like that. And it's just impossible to try and find an answer, and so we might as well be satisfied at not knowing and just go ahead and live our lives and be happy with what we have. There is the one I would describe as a naturalist, perhaps usually an atheist who denies God's existence, who would say if we're going to account for why we're here and what we're doing here and how we got here, we're going to have to look only at the natural world that we can observe around us. And our answer to that question is going to lie in things that we can see and forces at work that we can observe and data that we can keep. And really, we have no right to go any further than that. And so they might look out into the universe. They might look at the earth and try to come to some kind of an answer solely on that basis and no other. Now, for that kind of person, I would suggest that whatever answer he arrives at, it's really not going to be that important because there is real no moral imperative attached to his answer. That is, that once he determines how he thinks the universe came into existence and how man might have evolved, that really has no meaning in terms of how he should be living his life from day to day. But I think that there are a lot of people not falling into that classification who would at least accept the fact that there might be some superior being to mankind himself, who look at the universe and say, well, there must be something else here because man could not have just come into being. He could not have produced what we see around us. And of course, that would account for the fact that we find men have always been religious to some degree or another in an effort to account for why things are like they are. And of course, if we studied the various world religions, we would see that most of those believe in some kind of force that began things. Now, some would say it's not necessarily a personal force. It might be just some impersonal thing that got the ball rolling. But there is something higher, stronger, mightier than man that has brought things into existence. Well, of course, as far as those who accept the Bible as being God's revelation, there is an answer to the question as to why we're here. What's our purpose for existence? And when we look in the Bible account, we find immediately that there is indeed a personal, infinite being who has caused all that we see around us. Indeed, the opening chapters of the opening book in the Bible claim to be an account of how life came into existence, the cause as to how that came to be. But I want to suggest to you that there are those who would affirm a belief in the Bible that would balk at the idea that the chapters that we read about in Genesis are actually to be taken in a historical, literal sense. And I realize that maybe we've not all come across someone who has such a belief, but the fact is that there are those who would affirm that they believe in the Bible, and yet they would attempt to say that really the opening chapters in the book of Genesis are not intended to be taken in a literal fashion. Now, why would someone say that, you might ask? Well, I don't know all of the reasons, but I would suggest that as man has grown wiser and placed greater emphasis on his own ability to account for things as they exist, even so-called theologians have begun to approach the Bible from a different standpoint, not from the standpoint of accepting it as God's communication to us, so much as from the standpoint of treating these writings as solely the works of men and trying to account for why these men wrote the things that they did. And often it is the case among religious people that when they come to the book of Genesis, they treat the first 11 chapters in Genesis as being something other than literal, historical narratives of what happened in the very beginning. Now, why would someone do that? Well, you can just start looking at the events that are portrayed in those opening chapters. For instance, the creation of the first man and woman, Adam and Eve. Now, how does that compare to the theories of evolution that exist today that say that man evolved from some other form of life over thousands and thousands of years? That's in conflict with an account that says that God created things in 7 days. They would find, for instance, the account of Adam and Eve in the garden, taking a fruit that has been forbidden and eating that fruit, and that being the cause for the very first sin, disobedience against God. And they would say, now surely that is just symbolic in some way and intended simply to portray the general idea of disobedience as far as man is concerned. They would find repugnant, perhaps, the account in Genesis chapter 6 of Noah being chosen by God as a righteous man, and the only man who with his family God decides to save, and decides to bring a universal flood upon the rest of the earth, banishing the rest of the human race to death. And they would say, why that can't be the work of a loving God, and surely we're not intended to actually believe that there was a universal flood like that. And then maybe they turn to chapters 10 and 11 of Genesis, and they read about this Tower of Babel that men built, and God coming down and confusing the language of man. And they come away saying, why, we can't be expected to believe these events are actually as they happen. Indeed, when we read the genealogies, we read about men whose lives were much longer than anything we experience today, men living for hundreds of years. And so on the basis of that, I believe that many have come to the conclusion that the first 11 chapters of Genesis are intended to be symbolic. Now, as I say, you may not have ever talked to anybody that believes that. And that may seem fairly inconsequential as far as our faith is concerned. But that message hit home to me on at least a couple of occasions. About 10 years ago, I was auditing a Greek class at a Baptist seminary. And it became evident to me that the teacher, the Baptist teacher, did not have much of a belief in a literal historical account of many of the events in the Bible, much less the opening chapters. And he remarked on one occasion that a Bible class teacher had come to him and said, "I know that the account of creation in the book of Genesis is not intended to be real, so how do I teach these things to my students?" And it just hit me that that kind of thinking, so often attached to theologians, is filtering down to the common person. Several years ago, when we were living in England, I watched a documentary on BBC one evening. And this particular program was treating the question of the origin of the universe. And they began by, of course, giving scientific theories about the Big Bang and how the universe came into existence. And then they contrast that with the biblical account, 7 days of creation and how things came into being. And they came to the end of that explanation and said, "Now, how do we resolve these two things?" And the way they resolved that was, at the very conclusion of the program, they interviewed an Anglican bishop who turned to the first and second chapters of Genesis and said, "It's obvious that these two chapters do not fit with each other, that they are in conflict with each other, and that suggests that really they're only intended to be symbolic. And so you can work science along with what we know of what the Bible says and mix those two together and come to some kind of understanding as to what the Bible actually means." Now that's how people are tending to treat the Bible account, and especially as it relates to the early chapters of Genesis. Now our question is, when we come to the Bible account, how does God intend for us to understand those things? And really I want to do two things in the lesson this morning. First of all, I want to very briefly try and demonstrate that I think that these early chapters are intended to be taken literally, just as historical in the events that they describe as the events beginning at chapter 12 with Abraham and continuing on from that point. And then secondly, see if we cannot glean some lessons from even creation itself that will help us in our understanding of why we do exist and why we are here. In approaching the question concerning whether or not the first 11 chapters of Genesis are to be taken literally, I think that we have both internal and external evidence to point to that suggests that they are. If you look in the early chapters of Genesis, I want you to note that there is an expression that is used throughout these chapters. Now, I notice in looking through my New King James that the expression is not always identical because maybe the translation has changed a little bit, but let me suggest to you that with the King James or possibly other versions, the thought is the same, indeed. What I'm speaking about is the expression found the first time in chapter 2 and verse 4 of Genesis, where the writer says, after having given an account of the first 7 days of creation, he says, "This is the history of the heavens and earth when they were created." Now, the King James says, "These are the generations of the heaven and earth." But that word history conveys the meaning that we're looking for. Can you see that the writer, even in describing creation, is talking indeed about history? That is, he is describing for us how these events took place. And unless he had some figurative meaning that he describes, it would seem to be the indication here that he means that to be taken in just that sense. Well, we go on through the book of Genesis. Look at chapter 6, verse 9. And as is characteristic of the writer of Genesis, he says at this point, having introduced Noah, he says, "This is the genealogy of Noah. These are the generations of Noah." And he proceeds to trace through the events that took place during the flood. Well, we continue on. In fact, I've actually missed one out here. Back in chapter 5 and verse 1, we find the expression again, when after describing the events concerning Cain and Abel, the writer says at verse 1, this is the book of the genealogy of Adam. And in chapter 5, he gives us a link between Adam, the first man, and Noah, who is introduced to us in chapter 6. And then in chapter 6, as we've seen, we have Noah introduced. And then in chapter 10 and verse 1, after the flood has been described for us, verse 1 of chapter 10 begins, now this is the genealogy of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And he goes ahead to describe each of those. And then finally, he focuses in upon the descendants of Shem, Abraham proceeding from Shem. And in chapter 11 and verse 27, he says, this is the genealogy of Terah. Now, my suggestion is that just from the language that's used in those early chapters, it is evident to me that the writer is giving to us an account of history. He is not trying to portray these things in symbolic, figurative terms, but indeed he intends for us to understand these as literal events. And that internal evidence, I think, is emphasized by what we see in the second portion of Genesis that so many would admit to being historical. For instance, if you look at chapter 25, verses 12 and 19, after Abraham has had Ishmael his son, verse 12 says, now this is the genealogy of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's maidservant, bore to Abraham. And then again in verse 19, this is the genealogy of Isaac, Abraham's son. Later in the book, chapter 36, we find the descendants of Isaac, Esau, and Jacob, and their generations are described for us. Verse 1 of chapter 36, now this is the genealogy of Esau, who is Edom. And then later in chapter 37 and verse 2, this is the genealogy of Jacob. Now, if we believe in the integrity of the writer and what he is seeking to accomplish, and one is willing to accept that chapters 12 to 50 of Genesis are intended to be an historical account of events that actually took place, I would suggest, just on the basis of what we've looked at, that the first 11 chapters must be treated in the same way, to be consistent. That every indication is that these are real events that took place, that Adam and Eve were the first human beings created, that there was a flood during the time of Noah, that Noah, through his descendants, then gave rise to the individual of Abraham later on. But I think there's an additional evidence that supports that view, and that is an external evidence, that is, other writers in the New Testament, referring back to these events. How do other writers and speakers refer to the events described in the first 11 chapters? Well, let's just look briefly at some of these. We don't have time to go into this exhaustively. But Jesus himself is one who treats these things as though they are real. Look in Matthew chapter 19, verses 4 and 5. When Jesus is questioned concerning who has a right to be divorced, he appeals back to Genesis chapter 2 and verse 4 when he answers and says, have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female? And said, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Now, if the account of Adam and Eve are merely something that someone's dreamed up, why does Jesus himself refer back to these individuals as being the first man and woman and the basis upon which God creates the institution of marriage? In chapter 24 of Matthew, Jesus is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. And in verses 37 to 39, what does he refer back to tell them about what events are going to be like when the destruction comes? Why, nothing other than the time of Noah, in which men were eating and drinking and ignoring the judgment that was to come. It's interesting that Jesus himself takes the very events that so many say are meant to be only figurative and places his divine stamp of approval upon them. But Jesus was not the only one in the New Testament to do that. Look, for instance, at the Apostle Paul. Over in 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 15, Paul describes the role of a woman in the church. And having given instruction concerning her role, in verse 13 he emphasizes that in this way. He says, "For Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression." Now, why would Paul use this to undergird what he's saying as far as the role of a woman, unless those events took place exactly as the writer of Genesis suggests that they did? The indication is that these are historical facts that occurred. In Romans chapter 5, Paul talks about sin, and he talks about the period of time from Adam to Moses, treating Adam as a real historical character. And then finally, in 2 Peter chapter 3, you're aware of the fact that Peter there describes the coming, the second coming of the Lord. And in verses 5 and 6, in trying to emphasize this, he appeals back to the occasion of the flood. He says in verse 5, "For this they willfully forget that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of water, and in the water by which the world that then existed perished, being flooded with water." Why is it that the New Testament writers appeal back to these very events and persons so often to emphasize the point they're making, except that these are real individuals that lived and did exactly what the writer describes? And finally, one other thought. In Luke chapter 3, you'll notice that Luke gives a genealogy starting with Jesus and stretching all the way back to Adam. And there's never a break in that genealogy where he says, when he gets back to the point of Noah or Terah, why, now we're dealing in the realm of the unknown. No, he traces that right back to the very beginning, Adam himself. Now, I would suggest on that basis that we have a right, indeed a responsibility, to treat the first 11 chapters of Genesis as what they claim to be, a real, historical, factual account of how things came into being, both internally in the book itself and externally. Other biblical writers present us with evidence to treat it in that fashion. But I realize that I'm probably not talking to an audience that has any scruples about that question. And so, what do these chapters have for us? What can we gain from them? Well, very briefly, I want to look specifically at the first three chapters, and I want to draw a few lessons, if we can, from creation itself. Now, let me pause here to say that when I write on the board up here, this is not some coded, cryptic language. I often sit down at the back and look up there and say, no one could understand that if they wanted to. And one of these days, I'm going to learn how to use the projector here and make some overheads, and you won't have to go through that. But be that as it may, if you'll try and decipher what I'm writing up here, let's look at some lessons that we learn from creation. Some basic lessons that will really answer the questions concerning our purpose and existence here in life. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, we're all familiar with the very first verse that says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." How impressive that at the very start of the Bible, the very first verse is a fundamental principle, truth, that is taught to us. In unequivocal terms, God created the heaven and the earth. Now, unless a person is willing to accept that statement, in one sense, he need not go much further in the Bible, because much of what the Bible is predicated upon rests upon the premise in verse 1 of chapter 1, that there is an infinite being who has the power and the capacity to bring into existence the earth upon which we live and the universe that exists around us. And what a wonderful truth that is to be able to accept and understand. God created out of nothing. Over in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 3, the writer emphasizes this truth. when he talks about the nature of faith and what it enables us to see about the world around us and the individuals that lived in the Old Testament, he says in verse 3, "By faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things which are seen were not made of things which are visible." The God who created is a God who created out of nothing. He did not merely take things around him and shape them into the world that we find. He created from nothing, out of nothing. And you know, when we can accept the fact that God had the power to do this, there are a lot of other things about the Old and New Testament that are not so difficult to grasp. I almost hesitate anymore when I see some sort of program that's on concerning the Bible. I just almost start to shudder wondering what it's going to be about. Lately, recently, I've seen a couple of programs thinking, oh boy, you know, finally there's something about the Bible on television. And usually it's the case that whoever is doing the program proceeds to just pick the Bible apart piece by piece and tries to give some kind of natural explanation for every miracle you read about in the Bible. Why, if the Bible account says that Moses parted the Red Sea, what that means is that Moses led the Israelites out into the wilderness and they sort of went up here around the Red Sea and made it around there. And maybe there was a tidal wave that swept in from the Mediterranean Sea. And that's really what that means. Or if it says that God provided miraculously for the children of Israel while they were out in the wilderness by giving them manna, why, that means that there was probably some kind of plant out there in the wilderness, and they found that food, and so that's what they really meant when they said that God gave them manna. And so on and so forth. The fact of the matter is that if we're talking about a God who can create, then we have no problem with the fact that he parted the Red Sea, that he provides manna for the children of Israel, that he raises Jesus from the dead. And it's faith that enables us to accept that. Now, we're not talking about a leap of faith where we have no evidence whatsoever for accepting that. We're talking about confident conviction. The psalmist says in Psalm 19, verses 1 and 2, that the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. The evidence is there, but someone's got to be looking for it to see it. How often do we start noticing something because we've taken an interest in that thing? Suppose that you go out looking for a particular kind of car, and you've decided what kind of car you want, and you'll be amazed to see suddenly they're driving all around you. Well, why are you suddenly noticing that? Because you've taken an interest in it. Why does someone suddenly begin to be impressed by the evidence of the universe around them for the existence of God? It's because they're asking questions, important questions that need to be answered. God has created the universe. Well, notice a second point that's made in Genesis 1 is that God has created man, and that man is a unique being. In Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27, when God comes to the sixth day and creates man, he says, "Let us make man in our image according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. The creation account affirms from the very outset that we as human beings are special as far as God's creation is concerned. We have not evolved. We are not just some sort of animal on up the chain of evolution. That we have the image of God himself that resides within us. It just amazes me at times how far people can get in their rationalization of how man compares to the rest of the creation around him. I don't know if it's so much the case here, but in England, it just seems like the animal rights groups are forever bringing attention to the fact that we ought to give more attention and compassion to animals. Now, I'm not for abuse of animals, but it's amazing to me when people will give more time and attention to how animals are being treated than to how human beings are being treated. And that conclusion can only come when one fails to recognize that man has a unique place in God's creation. He has been created with purpose and for a reason. He has God's own image within himself. Well, this suggests that God has a right to tell us how to live. That we are, in one sense, the invention of God. Just as an inventor has a right to program his machine how it's going to work, God has the right to tell us how we should be living and what we should do. And that often answers the question of, why do I have to do what God wants me to do? It's because God has created us, and he has created us in his image. Well, let's notice a third point, and that is, when God creates man, that God does so in such a way that he can have fellowship with man. Men were not created just to be mere objects, to carry out the whims and the directions of God. That God, in creating Adam and Eve, intended to have a fellowship with him. Yes, he wants Adam and Eve to serve him, but the reason being that he desires a close communion and fellowship with them. In Genesis chapter 2, verses 16 and 17, notice that as he places them in the garden, the setting of the garden, he says in verse 16, "And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden you may freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it you shall surely die." Now this was a fellowship that was conditioned upon obedience. There were responsibilities attached to that first man and woman as far as their taking care of the garden was concerned. And that fellowship is conditioned upon their doing what God says. That suggests that we as individuals have a free moral nature. That we have the right, the ability to choose when it comes to God giving us his instructions. God has not programmed us in such a way that he makes us do what he wants. He has given us the choice, the capacity to think, to reason, and then to choose on that basis. Now, when he does that, of course, what that means is there is the capability on our part of disobeying his instructions. That we can refuse to do what he wants. And in fact, that's, of course, the next thing that we read about in the creation account, that sin can be committed and that there is a penalty attached to that sin. We've just read that God said, in the day that you eat of this tree that I've restricted you from, you're going to die. Now, there's a lot of question as to what kind of death that is. There is certainly a physical death that later ensues when Adam and Eve, having been taken out of the garden, having been cut off from the tree of life, eventually die physically. But there is a spiritual separation that occurs immediately when they eat of this fruit and God banishes them from the garden, and indeed with this close communion and fellowship that he has with them. That penalty might seem severe to us. Suppose I have a couple of pecan trees in my backyard. And I tell you as my neighbor, now look, you can look at those trees, but if you come over and you take one pecan, I'm going to take my gun and I'm going to shoot you and kill you. Why, you'd say, you don't have to be so severe. I understand what you mean. I'll stay away from the tree. And maybe that's what God's prohibition seems like to us here. Why would he punish in such a severe way Adam and Eve for taking of this fruit? Perhaps we could speculate to suggest that God is showing here that there is a penalty attached to violating his will. And if he had simply slapped the hand of Adam and Eve for having done what he said not to do, they would not have been impressed with what it means to obey and respect the commands of God and to do His will. And so at any rate, sin ensues from their disobedience of His command, and indeed, the very thing that He says will happen occurs. Now, looking at this account and looking at these very basic principles, we might just ask the question, does that seem so hard to comprehend? That God would create the first man and woman and place them in the idyllic setting of the garden in complete fellowship with Him, expecting them to obey His will and carry that out and giving a penalty to them if they didn't? I don't think that's so hard to understand. Indeed, as we look at our life today, if we would strip our world of all of the technology that we have, of all of the computers and cars and homes and all that exists around it, and we ask ourselves, what is the most important thing that life has to offer? Would it not be that we can have fellowship with God as a part of His creation? That we have been given responsibilities to do what God wants us to do? And that there is a penalty attached to disobeying His will? Where else could we start with someone if we were teaching the Bible to them and trying to make them see why things are like they are? Why there is a penalty for sin, why we have to be concerned with serving God. Where else could we go that would better accomplish that purpose than the very opening chapters of Genesis? Indeed, if we took these three chapters from the Old Testament, where would we be in terms of our understanding of what the Bible is about? They help us to understand what God has proceeded to do. And then in conclusion, let me suggest that the story doesn't end here because God does not leave man condemned because of his penalty. But the last great principle is that God demonstrates his love. Now, ultimately, that love results in the sending of Jesus, but we see a faint outline of that described in chapter 3, verse 15. When God says to the serpent, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. God could have left that first man and woman outside of the garden. He could have destroyed them to start with and said, well, that's it. And later he chooses to do so with the most of the human race, except for Noah and his family. He could have just left them to their own demise. And eventually, why, they would die and the world would be a miserable place. But God didn't do that. He proceeded from that very first point to effect a plan by which all of us, even though we sin, just as Adam and Eve had sinned, can eventually be restored to a place of fellowship with Him. Now, that's not without cost. He says that the seed of woman is going to have his heel bruised. There's going to be a cost attached to that. And ultimately, that prophecy is fulfilled in Jesus himself, who as the seed of woman is sacrificed upon the cross and suffers a temporary blow, a temporary defeat. But ultimately, that battle and that struggle is won and overcome when Jesus is raised from the dead, and he overcomes Satan. The head of the serpent is indeed bruised by his blow. The early chapters of Genesis are chapters of fact, not fiction. They are not figurative or symbolic. They are intended to describe to us exactly what God's plan for man is. And we have confidence that that's exactly what they portray. Others may call us fundamentalists and mean that in a demeaning way. But we can have a confidence in those chapters, and from those chapters we can learn the very basic principles that relate to why we're here and what life is about. Perhaps there is one here this morning who is not a Christian, and you have been asking those questions. And maybe you have pondered on these early chapters of Genesis and tried to make some sense of them. And maybe they have seemed more to you like myth than reality. But let me suggest that you consider what those chapters teach. You consider them in the context of God's revelation. You consider the basic principles that are revealed, that we have been created by a God powerful enough to do so, that we are unique in our being, that as a result we have a responsibility to serve God, and that even if we fail and commit sin, God has effected a plan by which we can be saved. If there is someone in the audience this morning who wishes to acknowledge that invitation, you can do so by coming forward and complying with obedience to the gospel. If there is a child of God who needs help and encouragement, we invite you to come as together we stand and sing this song.